Our next paper is by Hugh Gustafson, who's been a giant in this battle against the counterinsurgency use of anthropology, and has been, along with Roberto, the one who has brought it the most to anthropology's attention. His paper is The Cultural Turn in the War on Terror.
Thank you very much, Marshall. While the PowerPoint is coming online, thank you very much to the organizers of this fantastic conference. I've learned so much from listening to all the papers. It's been great. And I'm pleased that three of the founders of the Network of Concerned Anthropologists here, David Price, Roberto, and myself. The first image does go with the opening paragraphs. It's appropriate that a paper on counterinsurgency would have technical difficulties.
The University of Chicago is famous for its
Don't you often have to connect the computer after you turn the projector on?
Ah, there we go.
Okay, so I just press return to...
Yeah, and actually we've got your view there. Sorry about that.
Okay. Technical difficulties have been solved. American forces in Iraq have been experimenting with different versions of the phrasilator, a handheld device that translates between English and Arabic. New technical difficulties. So you press return, nothing happens.
You try just the, like, the down arrow? Can you just keep going and I'll get this back up? I'm just going to reload it.
Reload it?
Yeah. Yeah.
There are four slides for the first page. Ah, great.
So,
let's see if
next.
Oh, okay, right.
Back.
Yeah.
There you go. Okay.
You did that with page down?
Striding left and right. See if that is.
Okay. So American forces in Iraq have been experimenting with different versions of the phrasilator, a handheld device that translates between English and Arabic. One version has a repertoire of 700 complete phrases in its memory. This is useful as long as the Iraqis only use the 700 approved phrases. Another uses mathematical algorithms to generate voice-synthesized translations between English and Arabic. Another uses mathematical algorithms to generate voice-synthesized translations between English and Arabic, though it only comes close to working as long as speakers can confine themselves to one sentence of speech at a time and have the right accent. I like the bizarre story of the phrasilator because it shows how language and culture have become major problems for U.S. counterinsurgency forces, while also dramatizing the Pentagon's instinctive turn to inept, simplistic, and reductive fixes that seek algorithmic solutions to hermeneutic problems. The phrase later is an attempt to solve a problem that the 19th century military strategist Clausewitz theorized as friction. And he uses the term very differently than Anna Singh does. As Clausewitz construed it, this is the problem that on the battlefield, chance, irrationality, human quirks, and poor communication derange the heavily rationalized plans of strategists and generals. In Clausewitz's words, quote, "Everything is very simple in war, but the simplest thing is difficult. These difficulties accumulate and produce a friction which no man can imagine who has not seen war. It is therefore this friction which makes that which appears easy in war difficult in reality." End quote. The U.S. national security bureaucracy has come to recognize that culture is a source of friction in the so-called war on terror. U.S. troops find themselves fighting an intimately violent guerrilla war and trying to discern friend from foe in a country that speaks a different language, worships a different god, where real men hold hands, where free and open American body language can lead to serious trouble, and where hand signals have unknown meanings, while loyalties have a completely unfamiliar shape. In journalist George Packer's words, in Iraq, the Americans were moving half-blind in an alien landscape. Confronted by unanticipated insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. military is beginning to think of cultural knowledge, which General Petraeus refers to as a force multiplier, beginning to think of cultural knowledge as a sinew of war, much like airlift capability or ammunition stockpiles. The result has been a sharp cultural turn in the war on terror. The symptoms of this cultural turn in the war on terror are abundant. Most anthropologists already know about the Pat Roberts Intelligence Scholars Program, PRISP, a sort of ROTC for spies, which has been condemned by Britain's Association of Social Anthropologists, but not by the AAA. But most anthropologists are less aware that in the world of military colleges, think tanks, and contractors, there's been a sudden efflorescence of workshops, military journal articles, grant competitions, and job solicitations designed to leverage military use of cultural knowledge. Examples include culture summits in 2000 and 2008, sponsored by TRADOC. This is their logo. The Office of Naval Research's solicitation of proposals to study sociocultural modeling to understand asymmetric threat environments, and a request for contractor bids to develop a rapid ethnographic assessment program. Job vacancies for anthropologists and other social scientists have also been advertised by agencies such as the CIA, the Marine Corps, the 18th Airborne Corps, by the Counterinsurgency Center for Excellence, by Science Applications International Corporation, and by the U.S. Army's 4th Psychological Operations Group. And there have been faculty positions for anthropologists at the Air War College, at Air University, at the National Defense Intelligence College, and at the Army War College, some of these paying as much as $150,000 a year. Don't know what you're getting, Brian, but I was tempted for a moment. This cultural turn has been partly enmeshed with a turn to simulations. Kathy Lutz and James Dedarian have been documented simulated Iraqi-Afghani villages and towns built at the U.S. military base in 29 Palms, California, seen here, where soldiers practice counterinsurgency in environments peopled by actors playing scripted roles as community leaders, police chiefs, Muslim clerics, and so on. Forterra Systems has been hired by the U.S. military to produce multiplayer online environments populated by avatars representing U.S. troops, insurgents, police, and civilians. And when you play these games, there's a little trust meter at the bottom that scores how trustworthy you come across in your interactions with the Iraqi avatars. Meanwhile, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency has undertaken a $5 million initiative on computational culture modeling. The goal is to use cultural data to develop computer models that can predict the collapse of states and the eruption of terrorist movements, genocide, and insurgencies. This project, a computer-age stepchild of the Haraf files, is the idée fixe of Steve Younger, the former director of nuclear weapons development at the Los Alamos National Lab. Younger has spent years developing computer models of the emergence of norms of reciprocity in Polynesia, and unusually for a nuclear weapons designer whose PhD is in physics, is now listed as adjunct faculty in anthropology at the University of Hawaii. I attended a conference that he sponsored and was on a panel with a CIA psychologist who was talking about how great it would be to go into situations where you could give candy to kids and get kids to tell you what their parents talk about at the dinner table and feed that information into these computer programs to simulate what's happening in these situations. The next section is called Wallet-Sized Culture. The military's cultural turn has what we might think of as negative and positive modalities. I mean negative and positive here more in a Foucauldian than in an evaluative spirit. A negative modality is one that resorts to open violence and coercion, the tools of the sovereign in Foucault's terms. Examples would be the alleged use of anthropologist Raphael Patai's book, The Arab Mind, by interrogators at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. According to Seymour Hersh, U.S. interrogators used their Cliff Notes knowledge of Arab cultures to develop strategies for breaking prisoners' resistance that made use of forced public nudity and homosexual acts, smearing prisoners with fake menstrual blood, and using scantily clad women as interrogators. Positive instantiations of the Pentagon's cultural turn use cultural knowledge not for overt coercion, but to smooth away misunderstandings between occupiers and occupied and produce frictionless interactions. Examples would include the Iraqi culture smart card. Kerry, I hope my copy will be in the mail. And the Marine Corps primer on cultural sensitivity in Arab lands. The Iraqi culture smart card, Wallet-Sized Arab Culture, provides a brief orientation to Islam, Iraqi ethnic and cultural groups, female dress codes, and so on. It also has a section on Iraqi hand gestures, explaining that in Iraq, the thumbs-up sign is an obscene gesture. This might have been useful for Fox News commentators to know when they marveled in the early days of the occupation at all the thumbs-up signs American troops were getting from Iraqis. Like the Iraqi culture smart card, the Marine Corps primer on cultural sensitivity in Arab lands gives a condensed, simplified rendering of Iraqi culture as a set of rules and norms. It is the cultural equivalent of the phrasilator. Some of the norms as they are stated may not offer such a good orientation to Iraqi culture. The primer does start well, offering that, quote, touching among the same sex is not considered homosexual, and advising discretion in interactions with Arab women, while warning that our hand gesture for stop means hello in Iraq, a source of confusion that has led to many shootings of Iraqi civilians at checkpoints. But it goes on to say, quote, Arabs do not believe in cause and effect, but rather in isolated incidents or the will of Allah. And, quote, Arabs perceive problems as someone's plot to make their life more unpleasant. We may view this as paranoia. And also, quote, Arabs make group decisions. Do not try to force an individual to make a decision. If forced to make a quick decision, they feel no commitment to abide by it, end quote. The next section is called Human Terrain. Within anthropology, most of the controversy about the military's cultural turn has been focused on the Pentagon's new Human Terrain Team program, a program condemned by the AAA Executive Board. In 2007, one team was deployed to Afghanistan and five to Iraq. The Pentagon plans to deploy about 20 more this year. Each team is, at least in theory, made up of five members. Three members, the team leader, the human terrain research manager, and the human terrain analyst and military personnel. The other two, the regional studies analyst and the cultural analyst, are civilians. The Human Terrain Team program has become particularly identified with the anthropologist turned military consultant, Montgomery McFate. Following appearances on The Diane Rehm Show, Charlie Rose, and BBC World News, as well as profiles in Elle magazine and the San Francisco Chronicle, McFate is arguably the public face of anthropology today, the new Margaret Mead on a mission to leverage anthropology in the policy world and the public domain. Writing in the journal Joint Force Quarterly, McFate says that, quote, the ongoing insurgency in Iraq has served as a wake-up call to the military that adversary culture matters. The more unconventional the adversary and the further from Western cultural norms, the more we need to understand the society and underlying cultural dynamics. To defeat non-Western opponents, we need to improve our capacity to understand foreign cultures. And she has here, obviously, what I consider a very outdated view of anthropology is the study of the non-Western other. McFaith says, quote, a federal initiative is urgently needed to incorporate cultural and social knowledge of adversaries into training, education, planning, intelligence, and operations. Across the board, the national security structure needs to be infused with anthropology, a discipline invented to support warfighting in the tribal zone. Cultural knowledge of adversaries should be considered a national security priority, end quote. In recent public appearances before academic audiences rather than military audiences, McFaith has used quite different arguments in support of human terrain teams than she uses when writing for the military's own specialized journals. Speaking to anthropologists, she has eschewed the forcefully neo-colonial language she uses for military audiences and made a consequentialist argument structured around the pragmatist ethics of harm reduction, saying that she opposed the original invasion of Iraq, something that one hears repeatedly from anthropologists who are working for the military, saying that she opposed the original invasion of Iraq, she has suggested that, for better or worse, we are now stuck with the bad situation in Iraq, and she has argued that if anthropologists have specialized knowledge that would reduce casualties in a situation that cannot be undone, then they have a moral obligation to use that knowledge to save lives. She says, quote, does writing op-eds and being angry at the government help? Isn't it better to do something? She said this at a recent talk at George Mason University. She added, you have a choice of helping to reduce harm or feeling pure doing nothing. So there are only two choices, apparently. Either you help or you do nothing. You know, working to end the occupation, for example, is not a valid option in this worldview. A whistleblower, Xenia Helbig, who was expelled from the human terrain system when she made remarks indicating her opposition to an attack on Iran, has suggested that the human terrain teams are far less confident than the TRADOC public relations apparatus would lead us to believe. She points out that TRADOC has found it hard to recruit anthropologists, and despite salaries rumored to go up to $300,000 per year for human terrain team anthropologists, has often had to settle for recruits with master's degrees in such fields as international relations instead of the PhD anthropologists they seek. According to Zelbig, the four anthropologists recruited to her knowledge are specialists not in Middle Eastern culture, but in the Caribbean, Native American culture, the Philippines, and Latin American archaeology. These cultural specialists are hence dependent on interpreters in the field, and according to Helbig, their training at Fort Leavenworth gives them only a superficial introduction to Middle Eastern culture. Critics also worry that, as Derek Gregory puts it, cultural knowledge is not a substitute for killing, but rather, in certain circumstances, a prerequisite for its refinement. We know that human terrain teams are to construct databases of information on political leadership, kinship relations, economic systems, and agricultural output in military areas of operation. In Vietnam, a similar initiative known as CORDS, Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development Support, was, through the infamous Phoenix program, associated with the targeted assassination of 26,000 suspected Viet Cong. In this context, it's ominous that Jacob Kipp, one of the architects of the cultural turn, has labeled human terrain teams, quote, a CORDS for the 21st century. Roberto Gonzalez quotes a blog entry by Lieutenant Colonel John Gentile rebuking human terrain team anthropologist Marcus Griffin for his naivety about human terrain teams. Don't fool yourself. These human terrain teams, whether they want to acknowledge it or not, do at some point contribute to the collective knowledge of a commander which allows him to target and kill the enemy in the civil war in Iraq. So stop sugarcoating what these teams do. And as an aside, this was posted on Marcus Griffin's own website, and within 2 days of Roberto quoting it in public in a paper he gave, it disappeared. The whole website was taken down and has not reappeared, I understand. The next section is called Misrecognition. Besides the very real probability that human terrain team anthropologists collecting ethnographic information for Pentagon databases and intelligence analysts will become themselves part of the machinery of killing in Iraq and Afghanistan, there is, in the Pentagon's cultural turn, a sort of epistemological danger too. One dimension of the problem is hinted at in the following quote from Master Sergeant Rachel Ridenour, a cultural analyst for a human terrain team in Afghanistan. Military Times quotes Ridenour as saying that, quote, culture is a multifaceted thing, and our goal is to make the product as user-friendly as possible. Sort of a contradiction in terms within that short quote. I think Brian and Kerry have their work cut out. As Rob Olbrow pointed out in a panel discussion at George Washington University, the kind of culture the Pentagon wants, a product that can be condensed, objectified, and deployed, is the kind of culture Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict trafficked in. Culture that was, like other enemy communications, a code to be cracked. Not the kind of culture generated today by post-Geertsian ethnographers, many of whom are terrified to use the word culture at all. In such a situation, the danger to the Pentagon is that quite apart from the political costs of working with the military, the epistemology of its culture project may deter more sophisticated anthropologists from participating. The costs of depending on cultural analysts who have not absorbed post-colonial and post-modern critiques of anthropology are made clear in a brilliant and as yet unpublished paper by the geographer Derek Gregory. Gregory foregrounds troubling tropes in some of the cultural analyses that have been generated by the Pentagon's culture warriors, particularly David Kilcullen in the Afghan and Iraqi theaters of war. Gregory points out that these analyses tend to treat Iraq and Afghanistan as interchangeable, hence the generic Islamic villages used for training at 29 Palms. Gregory also points out that their frequent invocations of T.E. Lawrence index Orientalist tropes of unchanging Middle Eastern cultures, and that they overemphasize tribe and clan to the detriment of other principles of affiliation and mobilization. Such analytic errors are not a matter of mere academic quibbling. They have real-world consequences. But there is still more a still more serious sense in which the Pentagon's deployment of anthropology ends up perversely, entrapping U.S. forces in a profound misrecognition of their relationship with the other. Under the guise of dispelling cultural misunderstanding, anthropology ends up being implicated in the production of what it used to be fashionable to call false consciousness, in this case, neocolonial false consciousness, and I think that's part of what we were hearing about in the previous paper. The problem is hinted at in this story from the Washington Post. The American troops took some care to be polite when entering Iraqi homes. During Thursday's six-hour patrol, they handed out Iraqi newspapers and packets of gum and attracted an eager following of young children. But machine gun-toting Americans rooting through bedrooms, inspecting weapons and demanding identification cards, clearly unsettled some residents. One soldier on his second tour in Iraq said, "I was here last time in the beginning. Now it's totally changed. They don't even respect us anymore. They spit at us. They throw rocks at us. It wasn't like that before." Why do they hate us is a question that has been asked many times by American policymakers and pundits. A 2004 Defense Science Board study concluded that they hate us because of cultural misunderstanding. And the cultural turn, undergirding a misconstrual of occupation as what Montgomery McFate has called armed social work, holds out the hope that they will cease to hate us if only we engage in cultural mitigation. But the reason they hate us is not just that our soldiers often show the soles of their feet and don't understand the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite, but that in general, people do not like their countries occupied by foreign militaries. As seven sergeants argued in a remarkable op-ed in the New York Times, quote, "We need to recognize that our presence may have released the Iraqis from the grip of a tyrant, but that it has also robbed them of their self-respect. They will soon realize that the best way to regain dignity is to call us what we are, an army of occupation, and to force our withdrawal." End quote. While a little cultural knowledge is doubtless useful in greasing the wheels of occupation, the military's new culturalist paradigm evaporates political grievances into cultural grievances and holds out the fantasy that American soldiers will be loved in Iraq if only they get their hand signals right and learn to show respect for Arab women. Derek Gregory points out that the Iraqi avatars in U.S. military training simulations speak in ways that are scripted by the U.S. military, and so they cannot ask awkward questions about U.S. foreign policy or military operations. The silence of the avatars here mirrors a question forbidden to their interlocutors, a question whose very asking would undermine the salvation narrative of American manifest destiny. And so instead we have, in Gregory's words, a situation where, quote, "the emphasis on cultural difference, the attempt to hold the other at a distance while claiming to cross the interpretive divide, produces a diagram in which violence has its origins in their space, which the cultural turn endlessly partitions through its obsessive preoccupation with ethno-sectarian division, while the impulse to understand is confined to our space, which is constructed as open, unitary, generous, the locus of a hermeneutic invitation that can never be reciprocated." conclusion, future anthropologies. The war on terror is deepening the militarization of American society. It is enabling the national security state to build new constituencies and to penetrate disciplines and practices that were formerly off limits. As part of this process, disciplines such as public health are being remade through the power of Homeland Security money. And now, suddenly there's money for us too, if we're willing to engage in human terrain mapping and computational culture modeling. If we say yes on any significant scale, our discipline will never be the same again. Although most of the debate about anthropology in the war on terror has focused on anthropological participation in human terrain teams, in many ways, these teams are the least of our problems, and the debate about them is even a distraction from our real problems. First of all, only a handful of anthropologists are participating in the teams. And second, the ethical barriers to participating in the teams are so transparently clear to most anthropologists that there is little to debate. That is why the American Anthropological Association was able to make a clear, forceful statement condemning the human terrain teams, while its commission on the relationship between anthropology and the military, on the other hand, has so far been unable to make clear, forceful statements about the broader issues raised by the military's attempted rapprochement with anthropology. A deeper, more fundamental and insidious militarization of our discipline is underway that will be harder to recognize, let alone to contest. This is in some ways a replay of a match that the national security state lost in the 1960s, the last time it tried to mobilize anthropology for counterinsurgency. Seeing the furious reaction in anthropology to Project Camelot and the Thai Village study, and confronted with the 1971 AAA ethics code that condemned counterinsurgency work in the strongest terms, the national security state retreated at that time. Now, in a context where the AAA ethics code has been weakened, where the rise of practicing anthropology has changed the topography of our discipline, and 9/11 has created a new opening, the national security state has re-entered our world. At last year's AAA meeting, TRADOC personnel could be seen engaged in their own ethnographic study of us, busy taking notes at many of our panels. And at one panel, incidentally, a TRADOC person was seen writing down the names of people who had signed the pledge not to participate in counterinsurgency. Military agencies have begun contacting anthropology professors, asking if, for example, they would like to write reports on tribal cultures in Syria, or help construct detailed neighborhood maps of the practice of Santeria in Havana. The CIA has, for the first time in decades, tried to place a job ad in Anthropology News, and the human terrain team bureaucracy, unlike its predecessors in the 1960s, has reacted to the AAA's keep out sign by defiantly posting a recruitment ad on the AAA website last month, and with an email recruitment campaign targeted at anthropologists all over the country. They have made clear that regardless of the association's official position that it would be unethical for anthropologists to participate in human terrain teams, they do not intend to go away and they do not intend to give up trying to report us. Our ethical code is irrelevant to them. In parallel with the rise of an applied military anthropology outside the university, we can also expect shifts in academic anthropology. Last week, Defense Secretary Robert Gates announced tens of millions of dollars for Project Minerva, a project to create university-based consortia to interpret documents captured in Iraq, to set up an archive of materials on Chinese weapons programs, and to engage in research projects on jihad and religion and such like. In her book, Creating the Cold War University, Rebecca Lowen maps the profound ways in which the Cold War remade Stanford University, my alma mater. The government threw vast amounts of money at the physics department to build a particle accelerator and train a reserve labor force of physicists for the nuclear weapons labs. The political science department moved away from its older interest in high theory and ethically driven debate toward area studies, development studies, and a positivist conception of knowledge more in line with Pentagon epistemology. The communications department shifted towards surveys and polls useful for the study and manipulation of mass opinion at home and abroad. And the psychology department developed interests in obedience to authority, brainwashing, and influence of a kind that align nicely with the interests of intelligence agencies. Meanwhile, fracture lines opened up within disciplines between those who had clearances and those who did not. And there's a startling essay in Noam Chomsky's book, Cold War in the University, by a Harvard geologist, who talks about underwater mapping that was funded by the Office of Naval Research. And in the open literature, the maps were actually wrong. They were deliberately published to be misleading. If you had a security clearance, you had the algorithm, and you knew how to correct these maps and get the correct map of the underwater terrain. So it actually produced this system of fractured knowledge, where the open academically circulating knowledge was a deliberate misrepresentation. Thus, a possible future for anthropology is one where our high-status academic research is, thanks to increased funding from government sources and foundations, increasingly oriented to the Middle East, the new epicenter for area studies, and other aspects of the war on terror, while a new apparatus of applied military anthropology soaks up the PhDs who cannot find academic jobs. There would be specialized conferences and journals for securitized anthropologists, some closed to those without security clearances. And the ethics code, especially its constraints on secret research, would be weakened to accommodate these developments. Such developments are difficult for a community such as ours to resist. We are a decentered organization that does not license and therefore cannot de-license its members. And this makes it hard to impose a professional code of practice on our members in more than an exhortatory way. We are also an undercapitalized discipline that has in recent years generated a sizable lumpen proletariat of unemployed or semi-unemployed PhDs. And this makes us quite vulnerable to reshaping by government agencies with even relatively small, by government standards, sums of money. The network of concerned anthropologists is an attempt to counter such prospective developments within the decentered logic of our disciplinary apparatus. Its pledge campaign, and I urge you to sign the pledge if you've not done so, its pledge campaign is an attempt to make these subterranean processes of disciplinary militarization more visible, to incite debate about them, and to mobilize and dramatize principled opposition to them within the discipline. In an alternative future for our discipline, we might develop a counter-military anthropology and use our ethnographic skills to answer questions such as these. What was it in the organizational culture of the U.S. intelligence community that led to the false prediction of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? What was it in the organizational culture of the Pentagon that allowed it to invade another country with a plan most senior officers believed inadequate to occupation? How was it possible to take a professional army, committed on paper at least, to human rights, and create organizational subcultures where torture and human rights abuses thrived? How is the Pentagon able to attack country after country in violation of international law with the support of an American people who believe they're acting in the name of international law and human rights? What is it in the culture of American decision-making, saturated as it is with rational choice models and cost-benefit analyses, that fosters a misplaced confidence in our ability to predict and manage events and gets us mired down in quagmires like Vietnam and Iraq? Good answers to such questions would do more to enhance American national security than wallet-sized cultural cards cartooning Arab culture. Thanks very much.